Funding for Think comes from SMU's Certificate Program in Financial Planning.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What was daily existence like for the people of Jim Jones's doomed settlement in Guyana, and why were so many willing to accept a life of 12-hour workdays and subsistence rations in South America? The world was largely stunned to learn of 913 American lives that ended on November 18, 1978, mostly by poison drunk at the command of their leader, who had in fact been contemplating mass suicide for years longer than his followers realized. The People's Temple had been branded a cult by outsiders, but as writer Julia Shears reveals in her book, its members never saw it that way. They sincerely trusted Jones to fulfill his pledge of racial equality and economic justice, and in many cases, followers gave their children and teenagers no choice but to live and die at Jonestown with them. The new book by writer Julia Shears is called A Thousand Lives, The Untold Story of Hope, Deception, and Survival at Jonestown. Julia, welcome back to Think.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I want to talk about this at the beginning. You choose not to use the word cult to describe the People's Temple, not because you think that Jim Jones was a legitimate spiritual leader, but because the people who followed him, in fact, did believe what he said. Can you talk about why?
I also choose not to use that word because I think it's a loaded word. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the problems with the way that the American public has historically viewed Jonestown is that they've seen it with such a remove of the Jonestown victims being the other, being a cult, being sheep, being, you know, not like us. And so I really wanted, I think it's such a loaded term that I avoided it in my book.
Mm-hmm. It almost blames them for getting wrapped up in this as opposed to blaming the person who led them to end their lives.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. No one says, hey, I'm going to join a cult. Right. Check out this cult down the street. It sounds really cool. No, they joined Jones Church, because here in San Francisco, it was doing good things. It was a movement, even more than a church. They had, you know, clinics to help people get off drugs. They were helping single mothers with child care. They were providing medical care to the elderly. They were really doing a lot of good.
Jones was not born into a religious family. How did he initially get interested in the church?
That is an interesting story. So, yeah, Jim Jones came from a small town in rural Indiana. I'm also from Indiana. And his parents had this unhappy marriage. His father was a World War I vet who was disabled. His mother was the money winner, and she was kind of a figure about town. She drank, she cursed, she was a union organizer. So they were kind of seen as outcasts within this small town. And Jim Jones, a lot of the time, was kind of left alone to do his own thing. Mm-hmm. Well, one of his neighbors took him under her wing and brought him to church for the first time. And there he saw the preacher standing at the front of the church as this person who was revered and adored and, you know, having this type of attention and honor and esteem that he really wanted for himself. And so he, you know, instead of like fantasizing or playing doctor or lawyer or teacher and role-playing those type of things, he used to role-play being a preacher when he was a boy. Hmm. Because that's really what he sought, was this kind of adoration and respect that he saw the preacher getting at the front of the pulpit.
So despite the social climate at the time that he was in his sort of formative years, he did develop this what appeared to be a very sincere commitment to eliminating racism and working for social justice. How do you know the genesis of those ideas for him?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question now that we look back on, you know, what happened and everything we know about Jim Jones. Was whether he really had this sense of altruism within himself, whether he really cared for the plight of African Americans and poor non-whites, or whether he saw in that population a ready following.
Mm-hmm. He knew right? That his message would appeal to them.
His message did appeal to them, and that's how he got his first church. He went on the streets of the African-American section of Richmond, Indiana, and started preaching about equality. Well, he quickly gathered a crowd wanting to know what he had to say. I mean, in the 50s, Indiana was still deeply segregated. And he, you know, through his message and his outreach efforts and his love of media, quickly kind of went to the cusp of the cutting edge of civil rights in that state.
And among his earliest devotees was a pair of sisters that we come to really care about through the course of this book, Zipporah Edwards and Hyacinth Thrash, who called each other Zippy and Hi. And they found Jones through his TV ministry.
That's right. So Zippy and Hyacinth came from Jim Crow, Alabama, moved to Indianapolis as part of the great migration of African Americans, fleeing the racist South and hoping to find a better life and equality in the North. So they hadn't found that in Indianapolis. They moved into a house in this neighborhood that was desegregated by law. And, you know, the whites quickly fled. They faced racism at work and on the subway, the streetcar. So when they saw this minister on their black and white television who had this integrated choir, was preaching this message of equality and inviting believers of every color down to his church, well, they had to check it out.
What motivated Jones to move to California?
Jim Jones, as many people of the day were, was concerned about the possibility of nuclear attack, about World War III, about Russia threatening to bomb the U.S. off the map. So he told his followers that he had this vision that a atomic blast was going to go off over Chicago and that they needed to move to safety. And so after reading an Esquire magazine article about the 10 safest places to hide from a nuclear attack, he decided to go to Northern California. And that's how he ended up in this small town of Ukiah, which is about an hour and a half north of San Francisco.
And then he left the country for a couple of years.
He did. He first actually left the country to Brazil, hoping to establish himself there and then bring his followers to Brazil. Brazil was like the number one place in this Esquire magazine, but he couldn't make it work in Brazil. He didn't know the language. He didn't have any contacts. He struggled to even support his family. And so then he kind of, and his church back home started falling to pieces because he was the big draw. He was the charismatic, the leader, the one who was doing the faith healings. Without him, people started leaving the church. So he came back to Indiana with his tail between his legs and still insisted that his vision was true, that this attack would happen, but then decided, well, Northern California was a lot more palatable to people in the Midwest. They don't have to move to a foreign country where they don't know the language. They can just, you know, move a 2 days drive across the United States and settle in Northern California. And so this really divided people in his church. You know, they really had to scour their hearts and decide whether they believed this man and whether they believed in his message and were willing to partake in this movement that he was building. And it divided families. Some families stayed behind and others followed.
And once Jim Jones was in San Francisco, he began cultivating really powerful friendships, which strike us now as surprising. But talk about what convinced the city's mayor, Harvey Milk, other people of note, that Jones was somebody with sincere intentions.
Right. Well, what the local politicians were interested in were the numbers of followers that he had.
Uh-huh.
So he had a church based in Northern California and the Redwood Valley area, which is about an hour north of here. He had his main church in San Francisco by 1972, and then he had Satellite Church in Los Angeles as well. And he claimed to have, you know, tens of thousands of members to his church. I mean, he inflated his numbers like, you know, a lot of people do. But, you know, when you went to church, his church in San Francisco, you know, you'd walk in and there would be a couple of thousand people there. And they were willing to do whatever Jim Jones said. So Jim Jones said, you know, I want you to vote for Harvey Milk and George Moscone. They would do so. And so he was able to provide politicians with this army of followers who are willing to, you know, go door-to-door canvassing, who are really willing to populate demonstrations, and who are even willing to cross voting districts to cast their ballot for Jones' favored candidate.
Hmm. And it turns out that the relationships he had formed with these politicians may have interfered with investigations into his activities as they took darker and darker turns.
That's correct. When the allegations of physical abuse and of financial improprieties came forth, then, you know, these people, the mayor, George Moscone, Harvey Milk, who was George Moscone and Harvey Milk were killed 10 days after Jonestown, the mayor, the council member Harvey Milk, and the district attorney, they all refused to investigate charges of wrongdoing in Jim Jones Church.
Writer Julia Shears is my guest. We're talking about her new book, A Thousand Lives, The Untold Story of Hope, Deception, and Survival at Jonestown. If you'd like to join us, you can call in now to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Rollins Gilland here with Jeff Weddington. I am so excited about the entire day that we're having, but of course I'm also very excited, as I've said, about being here when, you know, Chris with her guests and Think, and of course Jeff Weddington is the senior producer for the show. So what is that number before we get any further into this?
You bet. It's 888-694-6931. 1-888-694-6931 is the toll-free number where you can make your contribution, or you can do it online at kera.org. Rollins, you're here all day today.
I am here all day. I'm here from 9 until 7, so I'm kind of like one of those full moons in the tropics. But I'll tell you, one of the things that's the highlight of my day is that the person I'm with right now, you know, you're not only the senior producer for a Think, but you also, of course, are the host for Anything You Ever Wanted to Know.
That's right.
But he's also the singer, the lead singer for the Psycho Ponies, which is a Neil Young tribute band, and I've had the good fortune of seeing you.
Hey,
so
thanks
see,
for coming
you wear
out.
Millions of different hats. You're just like Chris. She's a mother. She's a goddess. She's a, you know, she's an on-air, you know, talent of national proportions. I mean, what can you do? And I'm sure also a wonderful wife, and probably very smart when she's shopping in a grocery store.
She's a pretty stand-up person.
I think
Chris
so.
Boyd.
And but you know, the way you can be a stand-up person is to actually call this station and say, "I love this show. I appreciate these people. I appreciate everything about what Kaori brings to our lives and also what it means in the course of our lives here in North Texas." 1-888-694-6931 or
do it online. Click and join. Do it right now at kera.org. You know what you get from KERA. That's why you're tuned in right now. That's why you listen every day. This is the fall membership campaign. It's a special day. Rollins is here all day long today.
Rollins Marathon.
But you know what? We are still waiting to hear from you. For some reason, you have not yet supported the station during this drive. And you know, it really is up to you. We don't have to sell the station to you because you already use it. So we're just asking you and reminding you of how important it is and asking you to support it.
Well, we do, but I particularly feel during this particular part of the day that this is really a chance to really show how much we appreciate the real locally produced shows here at KRA.
You bet.
I mean, this is not an easy thing to do. And you know what? When you walk into a room and it looks beautiful and easy to have decorated, that means that they did a wonderful job because nothing's distracting. And that's the way I feel about the way you put that show together and the way Chris handles herself with a guest. It's all about us out there. That means you. I'm one of you. I call 888-694-6931. 888-694-6931.
Or do it online, kera.org. It is your public radio station. This is your show. Think is produced with you in mind every single day, so please support it. 888-694-6931.
Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Certificate Program in Financial Planning. You can gain a professional advantage with SMU's 9-month intensive CFP program starting in Plano this January. Learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer Julia Shears. We're talking about her new book, A Thousand Lives, The Untold Story of Hope, Deception, and Survival at Jonestown. If you want to be part of the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Julia, during this time that Jones was still living and preaching in California, he had also become a very regular user of a variety of different kinds of drugs. Can you talk about how they affected his moods and his behavior?
That's right. You know, he was so busy organizing this huge church, appearing at fundraising events, and just trying to manage his ministry, that he started using speed.
Mm-hmm.
And he would have these meetings late at night with his inner circle and staff where he would be talking and talking and talking, and they couldn't keep up. They're trying to chomp chilies, they're drinking coffee, and then one day one of his assistants looks in his toiletry bag and figures out, you know, why Jones has this supernatural energy. Well, aside from giving him this incredible energy and ability to speak for hours at a time, it also made him paranoid.
Mm-hmm.
And this, unfortunately, only became worse after they moved to Jonestown in Guyana.
Now, initially, he had set things up as sort of a Christian sect, and then over time, he lost complete faith in a biblical God and moved his congregation away from that idea, or most members of it anyway, as well. Can you talk about that change?
Sure. I mean, he started out as a, you know, Methodist, and then went to Pentecostalism, a preacher, just a regular preacher preaching the Word of God. And also using the Word of God passages from the Bible to talk about the need for equality. Well, he ended up casting away the Bible. You know, he wrote this paper where he talks about all of the errors and inconsistencies in the Bible and the astounding amount of violence that God seems to advocate in the Bible. So he decided the Bible wasn't true, that it wasn't something that should be followed, and that he had the real truth, and the real truth was this brother and sisterhood of equals, of, you know, where there was basically a socialistic principle of equality, where there would be no sexism, no racism, no elitism, no classism, and he was going to create this perfect society. This is what he ostensibly strove for, and ostensibly that's what Jonestown was supposed to be.
So when he first sent people down there, they sort of cleared out this space in the jungle and put up these little cottages and set up agricultural operations. Things were not so bad before he actually moved down there. Is that right?
Right. I mean, that's one of the most heartbreaking elements that I discovered, was the amount of hope that people had when they were going down to Jonestown. I mean, they had all different reasons for going down there, but all of them believed that they could come back at any time.
Mm-hmm.
So you had people sending their children down there thinking, oh, this would be a semester abroad type situation. You know, Jim Jones was telling that this was a mission field, that they were going to have this agricultural commune where they would grow food for the local Guyanese and help them get on their feet. Guyana was struggling to feed itself, and so that's part of the reason Jim Jones moved his church down there, was because the Guyanese government opened up, you know, offers to any group that wanted to come and settle in the interior of the country, which is virgin rainforest. And so Jim Jones took up this call and sent down pioneers as early as 1974 to start clearing the jungle for what would eventually be Jonestown. And so, again, you know, people went down there for all different reasons. Some of them wanted to escape the ghetto, wanted to raise their kids in a safe place. The older people thought, you know, this would be might be a nice place to retire.
Mm.
Or they thought they would go down there for a limited amount of time and come back, never knowing that once they got to Jonestown, which is a 2 days boat journey through the jungle, that Jones would confiscate their passports, their money, and tell them, you're not leaving.
With some collusion from the government, is that right?
Collusion?
Well, in other words, they cooperated with him in making it difficult for people to leave.
Well, the Guyanese government really had no idea what was going on. It is such a remote location from the Guyanese capital of Georgetown. However, that said, Jim Jones did have influence in Georgetown among the Guyanese politicians, as he did in California. He didn't have the number of people who were able to vote, obviously. This is a foreign country. Mm-hmm. But what he did use was these pretty temple women who would visit the politicians and the government officials in their offices, often brandishing very hard-to-get brandy, and basically letting them know that they were willing to do anything to help further the cause.
So he was prostituting his followers.
In one particular case, specifically, he was. One of the top PR girls, as they were called, was this woman named Paula Adams. Mm-hmm. He struck up an affair with the Guyanese ambassador to the United States, who happened to be related to the Guyanese prime minister, Forbes Burnham. And so she had an insider's view of what the Guyanese government thought about Jim Jones and was able to, you know, get all kinds of inside scoops and information about what was going on, as well as to pressure the Guyanese government to fulfill Jim Jones' wishes.
I want to talk about this. You mentioned the fact that, you know, so many people began this journey with a great deal of hope and a sense that they were moving to this utopia. You open the book with an anecdote about a boy at the time named Tommy Bogue. Can you tell us about him?
Yeah, Tommy Bogue, you know, in particular, you know, I had a fondness for him because he was like many people who were in the temple. He was a kid, mm-hmm. Okay? So a third of the people who died in Jonestown on November 18, 1978, were children, were minors. And you have to read the book to find out whether Tommy survives. But, you know, he was a 15-year-old who was sent down to Jonestown to kind of straighten him out as a basically like a reform school experience. Mm-hmm. He was, you know, ditching classes. He was skipping church. He was smoking marijuana. He was flunking out of school. So his parents thought it'd be best to send him off to the missions field. His dad had been sent down 2 years earlier to be one of the pioneers and carve this settlement out of the jungle. And so, you know, one of the things for Tommy, you know, when he got down there as a 15-year-old boy, the jungle was a playground.
Mm-hmm.
He sincerely enjoyed working with his dad and building this town in the middle of the virgin rainforest. I mean, that was thrilling for a 15-year-old. And when he wasn't working, he was spending time with his dad. He was palling around with a local Amerindian in the jungle. You know, there's wild animals, there's parrots, there's... I mean, for him, it was a thrilling thing. And for many of the people, before Jim Jones arrived at the settlement, it was a thrilling, exciting time.
How did things change when Jones arrived?
Right. Well, what prompted Jim Jones to move to Jonestown was a negative article that came out in a local press. So what happened was there was a local reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle named Marshall Kilduff, and he started getting this inkling that something wasn't quite right in People's Temple. He visited the church. He got the canned tour, you know, the people getting off drugs, you know, the old people in the whirlpool doing their physical therapy. And it just seemed a little bit too perfect. So mm-hmm. he decided to press further. And what eventually happened was he was able to contact a bunch of former temple members that gave him some real dirt on Jim Jones. And right before his article came out in a now defunct magazine called New West, the editor of that magazine called up Jim Jones and read him the article. He was on a flight to Jonestown the next morning. I mean, it was so scandalous. The ex-members were talking about, you know, physical, sexual abuse, financial problems. And so he came down to his settlement that he created under this cloud. His reputation irreparably damaged. And right from the get-go, there was this negativity and this gloom that settled over Jonestown when he got down there.
And punishments for anyone who committed even the most minor infraction were incredibly harsh.
That's right. You know, Jim Jones was so afraid of damaging his reputation. I mean, he couldn't stand it when people contradicted him. That's why, for example, if somebody left the church, he ordered them to move 500 miles away and not say anything bad about the church. Hmm. He would intimidate them if they refused to do so. You know, he would have people calling them up in the middle of the night, harassing them. He had all kinds of methods for intimidating people, but he couldn't control the press. And one thing he did in Jonestown was that he would brook no criticism. So in Jonestown, you couldn't complain about the heat. You couldn't complain about the food. You couldn't complain about being tired, even though, you know, towards the end, they were getting rice and gravy, essentially, to eat. He was keeping them up until all hours of the night talking about, quote-unquote, revolutionary suicide. It was hot. I visited Jonestown, and I passed out from the heat, and I wasn't even working in the heat. So he would brook no criticism, and those people who dared defy him or, God forbid, say that they wanted out, that they wanted to leave, he would isolate them in this unit that he called the special care unit, where he would inject them with Thorazine and basically make them into zombies. They would be bedridden and unable to communicate with the rest of the people in Jonestown. And for the rest of the residents, they would just be like, oh, so-and-so who got in trouble during, you know, the group meeting the other night has just disappeared, and nobody would know what happened to them until they would, you know, emerge from, you know, their Thorazine haze, or, you know, he also had this shipping crate where he would keep people.
Writer Julia Shears is my guest. Her new book is called A Thousand Lives, The Untold Story of Hope, Deception, and Survival at Jonestown. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can always interact with fellow Think listeners by going to the Think page of kera.org and click on the show title and put your comments there. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Rollins Gilliland back with Jeff Whittington as we continue with the Rollins Marathon all day and also our celebration of Think. Think, the show produced here at KERA with our senior producer Jeff Whittington and, of
right
course,
here.
The inimitable Chris Boyd. What is that number to show our love and support for this station and the wonderful kind of shows that you're listening to right now?
1-888-694-6931. If you make an appointment to listen to Think every day, if it's part of your day, if you wouldn't miss the show, and I know you do, listen,
yeah,
Rollins, because we hear from you all the time. Support the show, support the station, do it right now. Go online to kera.org. It's really easy. Just click and join. And you know what? The drive ends for you when you make your contribution. It's that easy.
Really? Honestly, this is one of the few things where we all feel so powerless these days. That's what I hear from everybody. We feel so powerless to control anything. Well, I can tell you, this is one thing we can control. If we call 888-694-6931 or go online to kera.org and actually give some money, we control the length of the drive. And I know that sounds like a cliche out there, but I promise you that nothing is more true. It's kind of like if you keep filling a bathtub and it overflows, that's a given. Well, that's the way it is. 888-694-6931 in order to fill up the coffers here.
And you know, Rons, we know because we talk to people who listen to the station, you and I both do, that, you know, when things are uncertain, you want to turn to a trusted source for information, for news, to find out what's going on. And on the Think Show, we cover a range of topics. We try to provide you with the tools, the information that you need to be a better, more well-informed
Absolutely.
Citizen. And you know what? And you get that from all the shows that you hear on KERA, whether it's the national programming, the international reporting. It's all designed to help you feel like, you know, we really do have more control over our world than maybe we think all the time.
Well, it's
and
like
that's
eating
what public radio
well
is all
versus
about.
Just grabbing stuff, you know? That's the
Absolutely.
Way I feel. I mean, I'm not just grabbing stuff when I'm listening to this station. But I'll tell you, you know, being very specific about the kind of shows I'm listening to right now, which are guests, of course, that you've lined up as the senior producer and that right now Chris is actively interviewing, I can think of times all kidding aside, I can think of times when I've literally cried listening to this show. I remember one time the film, the movie had done a documentary, mm-hmm. the Israeli documentary that was all in
Oh, it was animated.
Yes, it was animated. I'm sorry. I don't know. I just was so profoundly moved by him. And then, like, last week, I was so charmed by the woman who was had written the book, you know, The Chef, The Reluctant Chef.
Yeah.
Oh, so many different times. I mean, let's count the ways. But while we're counting the ways that we love this station and the number of times we've loved it and listened, I want you to walk down memory lane, but I want you to walk down it going 888-694-6931.
Yeah, don't be a reluctant public radio supporter.
No, Lord, I just hate that.
Log on to KERA.org right now. Do it right now while we're talking about it, because, you know, later on today you're going to get busy. We may not be here to remind you. You may not be listening later, and right now we're reminding you. So just take a moment
not on during the world.
And go to KERA.org. Make your contribution. It's really easy to do, Ron.
It is easy. If it was as easy to speed date as it is to pay money to this station, I'm telling you, I would be really busy. 888-694-6931. I guess I do feel like I'm speed dating when I turn on my radio in the morning. I work at home, and I'm either in the forest or I'm at home or I'm in my car, and it just seems like it's always KURA. And I didn't even realize how much until you started replaying Think at night, and I realized I'm often listening to it a second mm-hmm. time, which I really love. Again, 1-888, I hate to say this number too many times, but you know what? I can't say it too many times, because this is all about us having fun but also raising the money. And we do that by calling 888-694-6931.
It's a toll-free call. A friendly person you talk to will help you get through the easy membership process. You're just going to give them your name, your address, your information, credit card you'd like to use, whether you'd like to do a sustaining membership and have a portion of your annual contribution comes out of your account every month. It's really easy to do.
Very secure.
Or you can set all that up yourself if you want to fill out the membership form yourself. Do it online at KERA.org.
Which is easy.
Yeah, it's really easy.
The last time I did that, it was easy. I couldn't believe it. It's easy. 888-694-6931. I really appreciate all of you listening, but I can tell you right now, you're not listening because I'm here. You're not listening because Jeff's here. You're listening because you know that Chris Boyd is delivering the goods again with still another really amazing talent on the air. 888-694-6931 or online to KERA.org. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's certificate program in financial planning. You can gain a professional advantage with SMU's 9-month intensive CFP program starting in Plano this January. Learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer Julia Shears. Her new book is called 1,000 Lives, The Untold Story of Hope, Deception, and Survival at Jonestown. Join us at 1-800-933-5372, which is where we hear from Rodney in Denton. Hello, Rodney.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
I just wanted to make the point that Jim Jones was never ordained as a Methodist or United Methodist pastor. He was prevented from doing so because of the psychological problems that the church saw as he was in the process. So he was never really a Methodist preacher.
Thanks for your call. What do you know about that, Julia?
I think he was a student pastor, so he wasn't ordained as Methodist. The gentleman is correct. He was ordained with the Disciples of Christ.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about this. As he began to talk more openly about suicide, you reveal here that he had been thinking about it long before he made this public to all the members of his congregation. But it wasn't something, although it's been portrayed this way over and over, his followers didn't follow like lemmings in this respect. There was a lot of concern and a lot of debate over whether suicide was the right way to go.
Right. You know, you have this group of people who are moving down to Guyana to start a better life, or so they think, or, you know, to spend a couple of months, you know, to take a vacation, whatever their ideas are, they all of them believing they can come back. Well, again, they get there, Jones says no one's going back, and then about 2 months after he gets down to Jonestown, he's already talking about the fact that someday they're going to have to commit revolutionary suicide. Mm. You know, and the way he brings this up, a lot of these audio tapes, I have this one in particular on my website, where he brings it up for the first time, and he's asking the crowd how many of them plan their deaths, and why don't they plan their deaths? And somebody who has enough principles would be willing to die at the snap of a finger, and that's what he hopes to grow in them, this ability or to die at a snap of the finger. And it's just, it's stunning to listen to this.
I was really struck when you wrote about an 8-year-old girl in the crowd says, "What are you talking about?" And he just goes off on a tirade.
Yes, yes, you know, and this old woman, you know, he asks her, "Well, Sister Tally, don't you ever plan your death?" And she thinks he's talking about life insurance.
Hmm.
I mean, this shows you that the rank and file had no idea when they moved to Jonestown that he had these plans in motion, that he was planning to kill them. There were secretive talks in San Francisco already, in California, where he was talking about loading up the rank-and-file members onto buses and driving off the Golden Gate Bridge, or loading them onto airplanes and crashing it into the ocean or into the desert. So, I mean, that's the greatest tragedy to me, is that he has this vulnerable population, these vulnerable followers, a lot of, you know, African-Americans, along with, you know, educated people who want to make a difference, who feel that the civil rights movement didn't go far enough and that they want to be part of this, you know, equal movement. And these people who are very good-hearted, sincere people, having no idea that these plans are in place when they get to Jonestown, and once they get there, realizing there is no escape.
And it can't have helped that he kept them sort of weakened and hungry. So I understand that the land that they ended up on wasn't good for agriculture. He did not bring down a crowd of farmers. These were city people for the most part. But why were they starving, Julia, when the People's Temple had a great deal of money at its disposal?
Well, I think the answer is twofold. First of all, the rainforest soil is so poor. It's only, the topsoil is only a couple inches deep, and it's very acidic. And, you know, the Amerindians, the native people who live there, use slash and burn agriculture for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they quickly use up the soil nutrients. So the farm was a disaster. It was a disease. They couldn't grow food. You know, even their livestock was dying, and they couldn't figure out why. But Jones, he did. He had, you know, millions of dollars in overseas bank accounts. And I really believe that he kept them hungry and poor and tired, as he told one of his close associates, to control them.
Hmm. And before the horrible day in November of 1978 came, he had tested his followers before by telling them he was giving them poison and sort of checking to see if they would actually take it.
Right. So one thing I think most people don't realize about Jonestown, in addition to how, you know, far in advance the ultimate massacre was planned, was the fact that for months and months, you know, he would have these people up late at night telling them that mercenaries were surrounding him in the jungle. They were going to come in and torture them, torture their children in front of them, and then kill them. And how much easier it would be to just take this potion and slip over to the other side. He told them that he believed in reincarnation. And so one day, he actually staged a drill for what would be that final night. He had them line up and serve them what was essentially unsugared Kool-Aid.
Mm-hmm.
And then those people who protested, he made those people go to the front of the line, right? Hmm. So people quickly learned to, you know, to not say anything, to not protest, or they were going to be hauled to the front of the line. Well, you know, the first people were hysterical. They thought they were actually dying. And after a while, you know, the guards would take the people after they sipped this bitter liquid and then bring them out to this field. It was at night where people couldn't see what was going on. And then finally he said, "You didn't drink anything. It was just some, you know, a bitter punch." But what he gained there was he could see on the last night who was going to protest his plan and obstruct his plan, and who would follow through.
You had a particular interest in even approaching this book in the teenagers, especially because choices had been made for them to be there rather than most of them choosing for themselves. You have some experience, and you can sort of relate to what that must have felt like.
You know, I do. My first book was a memoir called Jesus Land, and it's about growing up in rural Indiana in a very conservative Christian household and then being sent to this Christian Reform school in the Dominican Republic. Well, there were a lot of weird parallels between my Reform school and Jonestown, like the punishments doled out to the teenagers, including, you know, having your head shaved if you ran away or, you know, being pitted in a punching match against another kid. But I think what I felt most was the sense of being trapped and isolated and powerless. At my Reform school, all of the communications to the outside world, our letters sent home, our phone calls, were all censored and monitored to make sure we didn't say anything bad about the school, right? This was a business, and they wanted to make sure our parents didn't pull us out of this, you know, this boarding school where they were paying a lot of money to keep us.
Yeah.
You know, and the same thing in Jonestown. Those people weren't able to get out the word that this man was crazy, that he was conducting these suicide drills. They couldn't get out that, you know, there was no help. There was this tremendous sense of powerlessness and doom. And, you know, my heart really went out to them. When I was going through the FBI files and finding these notes from people to Jim Jones saying, you know, I feel like a caged bird. I want to leave. I had no idea it would be like this. Please let me go. I'll do anything you want. I'll send you my paycheck for the rest of my life.
Hmm.
You know, or writing about their children having nightmares at night. My child can't fall asleep. She's afraid of dying, and I don't know how to make her feel that death would be a good thing. You know, it was heartbreaking to read those stories, but I think those people need to be acknowledged. Even at 33 years removed, I think we need to listen to their voices and rethink our conclusions about Jonestown.
And ironically, the reason that we are able to know so much about what was in their heads is because those letters were never sent.
That's correct. So long story short, what happened that, you know, provoked the last night was a congressman from California, Leo Ryan, mm-hmm. went down there to investigate Jonestown to see if people were being held against their will.
There were families of those people who were in Jonestown that said, we're concerned about what's going on there.
That's right. There was a group of concerned relatives here in California, and they got this congressman to go down there. Well, the congressman got into Jonestown, and as he was leaving, a group of residents said, "We want take us with you. We want out."
Hmm.
And then Jones knew the gig was up. So he sent a group of henchmen to the jungle airstrip as the congressman and the departing party were waiting for their plane and gunned them down. They killed five people. And then, you know, back in Jonestown, Jones closed ranks and said, well, now we're in trouble. Some of our members have gone and killed this congressman, Leo Ryan, the only congressman to be assassinated in office. And so we are going, the Guyanese government, the army is going to be here at any time. We need to take the potion. Now is the time before they come in and torture us. You know, so he set this all up very carefully, you know, and he really worked on how that last night was going to be played out. And as part of the investigation, you know, because it was a federal investigation, they killed this congressman. The FBI went through Jonestown after the bodies had been cleared out and picked up every piece of paper they could find, over about 1,000 audio cassettes of Jim Jones addressing his people, and they tried to piece together what the heck had happened down there.
Much of that story appears in the new book by writer Julius Shears. It's called 1,000 Lives, The Untold Story of Hope, Deception, and Survival at Jonestown. Julia, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.
I'm Rollins Gilliland, back with more of the Rollins Marathon, here with my great good friend and guest, the Jeff Whittington, host of Anything You Ever Wanted to Know and the senior producer of Think, the show you're listening to right now and thanking God is on every day from Monday through Thursday.
That's right, noon to 2, again at 9 to 11 in the evening. You can support the show that you listen to every day. Do it online at KERA.org. You might choose to get a copy of our guest's book. It's available at the $120 mm-hmm. membership level.
$10 a month.
You can spread that out as a sustaining member. It's $10 a month. You can check it out online. You can check out all the other thank you gifts that are available. Lots of great ways to thank yourself when you support your favorite radio station. Or you can call 888-694-6931. And talk to the friendly voice you talk to, the friendly person you're going to talk to. We'll walk
alluring.
Through the membership
They're alluring.
Process. And we'll give you all the options, especially when it comes to thank you
They
gifts.
Will. Yeah. I mean, it's just it's really almost like when you're on an airplane and they give you that book of all those things you can buy online. That's the way it is when you call these wonderful people at 888-694-6931. But let me tell you. The best gift you can get by calling 888-694-6931 is to support the only locally produced, and I might add nationally recognized show, Think, here with Chris Boyd and our senior producer. And, of course, along with him, he also, of course, is the host of Anything You Ever Wanted to Know on Friday. So those are our two locally produced radio shows, right?
Yeah, and, you know, we're thrilled that the station's able to bring those to you. You're thrilled that the station's able to bring those to
Euphoric.
You.
Euphoric. That's what they are.
You listen to this show every day. Why not support it? You can make your contribution right now on the phone at 888-694-6931. If you've been considering joining at one of the higher levels, perhaps you'd consider a friends level membership.
That's $1,500, and get a lot. You talk about getting bang for your buck. That $1,500 ends up getting you invited to things you would not believe. I mean, it's I can't even believe the number of things. And of course, that's also going to be. I mean, I could go on and on about all the things that are going to be happening.
Sure.
You know, with a 50-year celebration, but it's just pretty much remarkable. And a lot of people I know, and you would be surprised, of all ages, really have become friends level members at $1,500. Listen, Jeff, I wanted to ask you something. Look, I'm one of the people, like, I'm listening just like you are. Everybody out there in Radio Land, I'm always in a car, I'm at my desk just like you are, and I'm thrilled to be here, but I'm also thrilled to be actually speaking with Jeff Whittington because, you know, he is such an important part of why this show is a success and why this station is so viable. He also happens to have the best dog in the world, Omelet, and the best wife in the world, and a bunch of other things. I mean, these people lead charmed lives, you know, when they're not here, they're just reading back issues of Red Book and, you know, telling the nanny what to do. How long were you on the air before you heard your voice and thought it didn't sound weird?
Oh, you never think your voice doesn't sound. Yeah, it's you never get.
I
never
just
get
wonder,
there.
You know, because everybody thinks their voice is awful. I
well,
do.
I mean,
I don't know if you
think my
your voice
is awful.
No. I mean, I'm just asking somebody who's really in the radio.
Sure.
I mean, you know, really.
For me, it never sounds normal. But you know, it's just part of the thing. It's just there's a certain you kind of just have to get past it. And
I just wondered. I mean, it's the kind of thing I think some of us out there, you know, really wonder sometimes. You know, because any of us, when we hear a replay, we think we need to sue whoever recorded it because they've distorted our voice. You know what? I'm not going to distort the number you need to call. It is 888-694-6931. I'm going to repeat it, please. Why don't we repeat that together?
Let's do it.
888-694-6931. See, that's what coordination is here.
That's
at
right.
The station.
We worked that out. We did it. We did it live.
Absolutely.
We didn't really practice that either. I mean, it's
like you're buying the vegetables and I'm, you know, picking out a ham. Call 888-694-6931 and show your support.
Sure,
all kidding aside, for the wonderful kind of look at the kind of shows that are lined up here every day, Monday through Thursday, with Chris Boyd and Think, and they're lined up. I might add, by this guy here. He's the senior producer, and you know, and that's not easy. I mean, he is not seriously in a hot tub just receiving calls on a cell phone, you know, from people begging to be on the show.
Chris and I put our heads together, and we're really proud to be able to plan, I think, on a consistent basis, a pretty good week's worth of shows for you who
for
you're
me,
tuned in right
Colin.
Now, for you, Rollins, for everyone who's tuned in right now. You know, the decisions that we make here at the station across the board are all based on you. And that's why we're fine with coming to you a couple of times a year and asking you to directly support
the station. Well, I think it's three times a year you come. But you know what?
A few times.
It doesn't have to be very long if you'll call 888-694-6931 instead of saying you will. Some of you are like those people I used to date. You know, you say you're going to call and then you don't. Well, I want to know why you don't call 888-694-6931. You said you would. You've claimed you have. I know better. Call
888-694-6931 or click and join online at kera.org. If you're listening online, it's really easy. You're already there. Mm-hmm. Just surf over to the support page. Make your contribution. It just takes about 90 seconds.
It does take about 90 seconds. I tell you, sometimes when I'm listening to Chris Boyd in this show, I feel like going over and taking a bite out of that radio. It's so spiritually and intellectually nutritious. 888-694-6931. 888-694-6931 or online to kera.org. Thank you.